during which nothing happened. The hearts beat thunderously in the circle, and a small vein on the side of each neck throbbed in harmony with each heart. The heads turned quickly from side to side as each man assured himself of his neighbours, and the breath of life streamed away on the north wind sweetly as each realised how beautiful life was, which a reeking tusk might in a few seconds rape away from one or another of them if things went wrong. The boar did not express his fury with his voice. There was no uproar in the covert or yelping from the limers. Only, about 100 yards away from the wart, there was suddenly a black creature standing on the edge of the clearing. It did not seem to be a boar particularly, not in the first seconds that it stood there. It had come too quickly to seem to be anything. It was charging Sir Grummore before the wart had recognised what it was. The black thing rushed over the white snow, throwing up little puffs of it. Sir Grummore, also looking black against the snow, turned a quick somersault in a larger puff. A kind of grunt, but no noise of falling, came clearly on the north wind, and then the boar was gone. When it was gone, but not before, the wart knew certain things about it, things which he had not had time to notice while the boar was there. He remembered the rank mane of bristles standing upright on its razor back, one flash of a sour tush, the staring ribs, the head held low, and the red flame from a piggy eye. Sir Grummore got up, dusting snow out of himself, unhurt, blaming his spear. A few drops of blood were to be seen frothing on the white earth. Master Twitey put his horn to his lips. The allaunts were uncoupled as the exciting notes of the menet began to ring through the forest, and then the whole scene began to move. The limers which had reared the boar, the proper word for dislodging, were allowed to pursue him to make them keen on their work. The bratchets gave musical tongue. The allaunts galloped baying through the drifts. Everybody began to shout and run. "Avoy! Avoy!" cried the foot people. "Shahoo! Shahoo! Avaunt, sire! Avaunt!" "Sweff! Sweff!" cried Master Twitey anxiously. "Now, now, gentlemen, give the hounds room, if you please!"
"I say!" cried King Pellinore. "Did anybody see which way he went? What an exciting day! What? Sa! Sa! Sai! Avaunt! Sai! Sa! Avaunt! Sa! Sai! Avaunt!"
"Hold hard, Pellinore!" cried Sir Ector. "Where hounds, man? Where hounds? Can't catch him yourself, you know. Il est ho! Il est ho!"
And "Till it ho!" echoed the foot people. "Tilly ho!" sang the trees. "Tally ho!"
murmured the distant snowdrifts, as the heavy branches, disturbed by the vibrations, slid noiseless puffs of sparkling powder to the muffled earth. The wart found himself running with Master Twitey. It was like beagling in a way, except that it was beagling in a forest where it was sometimes difficult even to move. Everything depended on the music of the hounds and the various notes which the huntsman could blow to tell where he was and what he was doing. Without these, the whole field would have been lost in 2 minutes, and even with them, about half of it was lost in 3. Wart stuck to Twitey like a burr. He could move as quickly as the huntsman, because although the latter had the experience of a lifetime, he himself was smaller to get through obstacles and had, moreover, been taught by Maid Marian. He noticed that Robin kept up, too, but soon the grunting of Sir Ector and the baaing of King Pellinore were left behind. Sir Grummore had given in early, having had most of the breath knocked out of him by the boar, and stood far in the rear, declaring that his spear could no longer be quite sharp. Kay had stayed with him, so that he should not get lost. The foot people had been early mislaid, because they did not understand the notes of the horn. Merlin had torn his breeches and stopped to mend them up by magic. The sergeant had thrown out his chest so far in crying tally-ho and telling everybody which way they ought to run that he had lost all sense of place and was leading a disconsolate party of villagers in Indian file at the double with knees up in the wrong direction. Hob was still in the running.
"Sweff! Sweff!" panted the huntsman, addressing the wart as if he had been a hound. "Not so fast, master. They are going off the line."
Even as he spoke, Wart noticed that the hound music was weaker and more querulous.
Stop, said Robin, or we may tumble over him.
The music died away.
Swerf! Swerf!
Shouted Master Twitey at the top of his voice.
Stow a rare! So ho! So ho!
He swung his baldric in front of him, and lifting the horn to his lips, began to blow a recheat. There was a single note from one of the limers.
Hoo a rare!
Cried the huntsman. The limer's note grew in confidence, faltered, then rose to the full bay.
Hoo-a-rare! Hear how a me! Hark to Beaumont the Valiant! Ho-moy! Ho-moy! Hole, 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 hole!
The limer was taken up by the tenor bells of the Bratchets. The noises grew to a crescendo of excitement as the bloodthirsty thunder of the allaunts pealed through the lesser notes.
They have him, said Twitey briefly. And the three humans began to run again, while the huntsman blew encouragement with True-roo-root!
In a small bushment, the grim boar stood at bay. He had got his hindquarters into the nook of a tree blown down by a gale, in an impregnable position. He stood on the defensive, with his upper lip writhed back in a snarl. The blood of Sir Grummore's gash welled fatly among the bristles of his shoulder and down his leg, while the foam of his chops dropped on the blushing snow and melted it. His small eyes darted in every direction. The hound stood round, yelling at his mask, and Beaumont, with his back broken, writhed at his feet. He paid no further attention to the living hound, which could do him no harm. He was black, flaming, and bloody.
So ho!
Said the huntsman. He advanced with his spear held in front of him, and the hounds, encouraged by their master, stepped forward with him pace by pace. The scene changed as suddenly as a house of cards falling down. The boar was not at bay any more, but charging Master Twitey. As it charged, the allaunts closed in, seizing it fiercely by the shoulder or throat or leg, so that what surged down on the huntsman was not one boar but a bundle of animals. He dared not use his spear for fear of hurting the dogs. The bundle rolled forward unchecked, as if the hounds did not impede it at all. Twitey began to reverse his spear, to keep the charge off with its butt end. But even as he reversed it, the tussle was upon him. He sprang back, tripped over a root, and the battle closed on top. The wart pranced round the edge, waving his own spear in an agony, but there was nowhere he dared to thrust it in. Robin dropped his spear, drew his falchion in the same movement, stepped into the huddle of snarls, and calmly picked up an allaunt by the leg. The dog did not let go, but there was space where its body had been. Into this space the falchion went slowly. Once, twice, thrice. The whole superstructure stumbled, recovered itself, stumbled again, and sank down ponderously on its left side. The hunt was over. Master Twitey drew one leg slowly from under the boar, stood up, took hold of his knee with his right hand, moved it inquiringly in various directions, nodded to himself, and stretched his back straight. Then he picked up his spear without saying anything and limped over to Beaumont. He knelt down beside him and took his head on his lap. He stroked Beaumont's head and said, "Hark to Beaumont. Softly, Beaumont, mon ami. Oyez a Beaumont the Valiant. Swef le douce Beaumont. Swef, swef." Beaumont licked his hand, but could not wag his tail. The huntsman nodded to Robin, who was standing behind, and held the hound's eyes with his own. He said, "Good dog, Beaumont, the Valiant. Sleep now, old friend Beaumont, good old dog." Then Robin's falchion let Beaumont out of this world to run free with Orion and roll among the stars. The wart did not like to watch Master Twitey for a moment. The strange, leathery man stood up without saying anything, and whipped the hounds off the corpse of the boar as he was accustomed to do. He put his horn to his lips and blew the four long notes of the mort without a quaver. But he was blowing the notes for a different reason, and he startled the wart because he seemed to be crying. The mort brought most of the stragglers up in due time. Hob was there already, and Sir Ector came next, whacking the brambles aside with his boar spear, puffing importantly and shouting, "Well done, Twitey! Splendid hunt, very! That's the way to chase a beast of venery, I will say! What does he weigh?" The others dribbled in by batches, King Pellinore bounding along and crying out, "Tally-ho! Tally-ho! Tally-ho!" in ignorance that the hunt was done. When informed of this, he stopped and said, "Tally-ho, what?" in a feeble voice, then relapsed into silence. Even the sergeant's Indian file arrived in the end, still doubling with knees up, and were halted in the clearing while the sergeant explained to them with great satisfaction that, if it had not been for him, all would have been lost. Merlin appeared, holding up his running shorts, having failed in his magic. Sir Grammor came stumping along with Kay, saying that it had been one of the finest points he had ever seen run, although he had not seen it, and then the butcher's business of the undoing was proceeded with apace. Over this there was a bit of excitement. King Pellinore, who had really been scarcely himself all day, made the fatal mistake of asking when the hounds were going to be given their quarry. Now, as everybody knows, a quarry is a reward of entrails, etc., which is given to the hounds on the hide of the dead beast, sur le cuir. And, as everybody else knows, a slain boar is not skinned. It is disemboweled without the hide being taken off, and since there can be no hide, there can be no quarry. We all know that the hounds are rewarded with a foile, or mixture of bowels and bread cooked over a fire, and, of course, poor King Pellinore had used the wrong word. So King Pellinore was bent over the dead beast amid loud huzzas, and the protesting monarch was given a hearty smack with a sword blade by Sir Ector. The king then said, "I think you're all a lot of beastly cads," and wandered off, mumbling, into the forest. The boar was undone, the hounds rewarded, and the foot people standing about in chattering groups, because they would have got wet if they'd sat down in the snow, ate the provisions which the young women had brought in baskets. A small barrel of wine, which had been thoughtfully provided by Sir Ector, was broached, and a good drink was had by all. The boar's feet were tied together, a pole was slipped between his legs, and two men hoisted it upon their shoulders. William Twitey stood back and courteously blew the prease. It was at this moment that King Pellinore reappeared. Even before he came into view, they could hear him crashing in the undergrowth and calling out,
I say, come here at once! A most dreadful thing has happened!"
He appeared dramatically upon the edge of the clearing, just as a disturbed branch, whose burden was too heavy, emptied a couple of hundredweight of snow on his head. King Pellinore paid no attention. He climbed out of the snow heap as if he had not noticed it, still calling out,
"I say, I say!"
"What is it, Pellinore?" shouted Sir Ector.
"Oh, come quick!" cried the king,
and turning round, distracted, he vanished again into the forest.
"Is he all right?" inquired Sir Ector. "Do you suppose?"
"Excitable character," said Sir Grammore, "very."
"Better follow up and see what he's doing."
The procession moved off sedately in King Pellinore's direction, following his erratic course by the fresh tracks in the snow. The spectacle which they came across was one for which they were not prepared. In the middle of a dead gorse bush, King Pellinore was sitting, with tears streaming down his face. In his lap there was an enormous snake's head, which he was patting. At the other end of the snake's head, there was a long, lean, yellow body with spots on it. At the end of the body, there were some lion's legs, which ended in the slots of a heart.
"There, there," the king was saying. "I did not mean to leave you altogether. It was only because I wanted to sleep in a feather bed just for a bit. I was coming back, honestly I was. Oh, please don't die, beast, and leave me without any fumets."
When he saw Sir Ector, the king took command of the situation. Desperation had given him authority.
"Now then, Ector," he exclaimed, "don't stand there like a ninny. Fetch that barrel of wine along at once."
They brought the barrel and poured out a generous tot for the questing beast.
"Poor creature," said King Pellinore indignantly. "It is pined away, positively pined away, just because there was nobody to take an interest in it. How I could have stayed all that while with Sir Grummore, never given my old beast a thought, I really don't know. Look at his ribs, I ask you, like hoops of a barrel, and lying out in the snow all by itself, almost without the will to live. Come on, beast, you see if you can't get down another gulp of this. It will do you good. Mollicking about in a feather bed," added the remorseful monarch, glaring at Sir Grummore, like a kidney.
"But how did you find it?" faltered Sir Grummore.
"I happened on it, and small thanks to you, running about like a lot of nincompoops and smacking each other with swords. I happened on it in this gorse bush here, with snow all over its poor back and tears in its eyes, and nobody to care for it in the wide world. It's what comes of not leading a regular life. Before, it was all right. We got up at the same time and quested for regular hours and went to bed at 10:30. Now look at it. It has gone to pieces altogether, and it will be your fault if it dies, you and your bed."
"But Pellinore," said Sir Grummore.
"Shut your mouth," replied the king at once. "Don't stand there bleating like a fool, man. Do something. Fetch another pole so that we can carry old Glatizant home. Now then, Ector, haven't you got any sense? We must just carry him home and put him in front of the kitchen fire. Send somebody on to make some bread and milk. And you, Twitey, or whatever you choose to call yourself, stop fiddling with that trumpet of yours and run ahead to get some blankets warmed. When we get home," concluded King Pellinore, "the first thing will be to give it a nourishing meal, and then, if it is all right in the morning, I will give it a couple of hours' start, and then hey-ho for the old life once again. What about that, Glatizant, hey? You'll tack the high road, and I'll tack the low road, what? Come along, Robin Hood, or whoever you are. You may think I don't know, but I do. Stop leaning on your bow with that look of negligent woodcraft. Pull yourself together, man, and get that muscle-bound sergeant to help you carry her. Now then, lift her easy. Come along, you chuckleheads, and mind you don't trip. Feather beds and quarry, indeed. A lot of childish nonsense. Go on, advance, proceed, step forward, march. Feather brains, I call it, that's what I do. But as for you, Grummore," added the king, even after he had concluded, "you could just roll yourself up in your bed and stifle in it."
Chapter 17.
"I think it must be time," said Merlin, looking at him over the top of his spectacles one afternoon, "that you had another dose of education. That is, as time goes."
It was an afternoon in early spring, and everything outside the window looked beautiful. The winter mantle had gone, taking with it Sir Grummore, Master Twitey, King Pellinore, and the questing beast, the latter having revived under the influence of kindliness and bread and milk. It had bounded off into the snow with every sign of gratitude, to be followed 2 hours later by the excited king, and the watchers from the battlements had observed it confusing its snowy footprints most ingeniously as it reached the edge of the chase. It was running backward, bounding 20 foot sideways, rubbing out its marks with its tail, climbing along horizontal branches, and performing many other tricks with evident enjoyment. They had also seen King Pellinore, who had dutifully kept his eyes shut and counted 10,000 while this was going on, becoming quite confused when he arrived at the difficult spot, and finally galloping off in the wrong direction with his brachet trailing behind him. It was a lovely afternoon. Outside the schoolroom window, the larches of the distant forest had already taken on the fullness of their dazzling green. The earth twinkled and swelled with a million drops, and every bird in the world had come home to court and sing. The village folk were forth in their gardens every evening, planting garden beans, and it seemed that what with these emergencies and those of the slugs, coincidentally with the beans, The buds, the lambs and the birds, every living thing, had conspired to come out.
"What would you like to be?" asked Merlin.
Wart looked out of the window, listening to the thrush's twice-done song of dew. He said, "I've been a bird once, but it was only in the mews at night, and I never got a chance to fly. Even if one ought not to do one's education twice, do you think I could be a bird so as to learn about that?" He had been bitten with the craze for birds which bites all sensible people in the spring, and which sometimes even leads to excesses like birds' nesting.
"I can see no reason why you should not," said the magician. "Why not try it at night?"
"But they will all be asleep at night."
"All the better chance of seeing them without their flying away. You could go with Archimedes this evening, and he would tell you about them."
"Would you do that, Archimedes?"
"I should love to," said the owl. "I was feeling like a little saunter myself."
"Do you know," asked the wart, thinking of the thrush, "why birds sing, or how? Is it a language?"
"Of course it's a language. It is not a big language like human speech, but it is large."
"Gilbert White," said Merlin, "remarks, or will remark, however you like to put it, that the language of birds is very ancient, and like other ancient modes of speech, little is said, but much is intended. He also says somewhere that the rooks in the breeding season attempt sometimes in the gaiety of their hearts to sing, but with no great success."
"I love rooks," said the wart. "It's funny, but I think they're my favourite birds."
"Why?"
asked Archimedes. "Well, I like them. I like their sauce."
"Neglectful parents," quoted Merlin, who was in a scholarly mood, "and saucy, perverse children."
"It is true," said Archimedes reflectively, "that all the corvidae have a distorted sense of humour."
Wart explained. "I love the way they enjoy flying. They don't just fly like other birds, but they fly for fun. It is lovely when they hoist home to bed in a flock at night, all cheering and making rude remarks and pouncing on each other in a vulgar way. They turn over on their backs sometimes and tumble out of the air just to be ridiculous, or else because they've forgotten they're flying and have coarsely begun to scratch themselves for fleas without thinking about it."
"They are intelligent birds," said Archimedes, "in spite of their low humour. They are one of the birds that have parliaments, you know, and a social system."
"Do you mean they have laws?"
"Certainly they have laws. They meet in the autumn in a field to talk them over."
"What sort of laws?"
"Oh, well, laws about the defence of the rookery and marriage and so forth. You are not allowed to marry outside the rookery, and if you do become quite lost to all sense of decency and bring back a sable virgin from a neighbouring settlement, then everybody pulls your nest to pieces as fast as you can build it up. They make you go into the suburbs, you know, and that is why every rookery has outlying nests all around it several trees away."
"Another thing I like about them," said the wart, "is their go. They may be thieves and practical jokers, and they do quarrel and bully each other in a squawky way, but they've got the courage to mob their enemies. I think it takes some courage to mob a hawk, even if there is a pack of you, and even while they're doing it they clown."
"They are mobs," said Archimedes loftily. "You have said the word."
"Well, they're larky mobs anyway," said the wart, "and I like them."
"What is your favourite bird?"
asked Merlin politely, to keep the peace. Archimedes thought this over for some time and then said,
"Well, it is a large question. It is rather like asking you, what is your favourite book? On the whole, however, I think that I must prefer the pigeon."
"To eat?"
"I was leaving that side of it out,"
said the owl in civilised tones.
"Actually, the pigeon is the favourite dish of all raptors, if they are big enough to take her.
but I was thinking of nothing but domestic habits.
Describe them.
The pigeon, said Archimedes, is a kind of Quaker. She dresses in grey. A dutiful child, a constant lover, and a wise parent, she knows, like all philosophers, that the hand of every man is against her. She has learned throughout the centuries to specialize in escape. No pigeon has ever committed an act of aggression, nor turned upon her persecutors, but no bird likewise is so skilful in eluding them. She has learned to drop out of a tree on the opposite side to man, and to fly low so that there is a hedge between them. No other bird can estimate a range so well. Vigilant, powdery, odorous and loose-feathered, so that dogs object to taking them in their mouths. Armoured against pellets by the padding of these feathers, the pigeons coo to one another with true love, nourish their cunningly hidden children with true solicitude, and flee from the aggressor with true philosophy. A race of peace-lovers, continually caravanning away from the destructive Indian in covered wagons. They are loving individualists, surviving against the forces of massacre only by wisdom in escape. Did you know, added Archimedes, that a pair of pigeons always roosts head to tail so that they can keep a lookout in both directions?
I know our tame pigeons do, said the wart. I suppose the reason why people are always trying to kill them is because they're so greedy. What I like about wood pigeons is the clap of their wings and how they soar up and close their wings and sink during their courting flights so that they fly rather like woodpeckers.
It is not very like woodpeckers, said Merlin.
No, it is not, admitted the wart.
And what is your favourite bird? Asked Archimedes, feeling that his master ought to be allowed a say.
Merlin put his fingers together like Sherlock Holmes and replied immediately,
I prefer the chaffinch. My friend Linnaeus calls him Celebs, or bachelor bird. The flocks have the sense to separate during the winter, so that all the males are in one flock and all the females in the other. For the winter months, at any rate, there is perfect peace.
The conversation, observed Archimedes, arose out of whether birds could talk.
Another friend of mine, said Merlin immediately in his most learned voice, maintains, or will maintain, that the question of the language of birds arises out of imitation. Aristotle, you know, also attributes tragedy to imitation.
Archimedes sighed heavily and remarked in prophetic tones,
You had better get it off your chest.
It is like this, said Merlin. The kestrel drops upon a mouse, and the poor mouse, transfixed with those needle talons, cries out in agony his one squeal of key. Next time the kestrel sees a mouse, his own soul cries out key in imitation. Another kestrel, perhaps his mate, comes to that cry, and after a few million years, all the kestrels are calling each other with their individual note of key, key, key.
You can't make the whole story out of one bird, said the wart.
I don't want to. The hawks scream like their prey. The mallards croak like the frogs they eat. The shrikes also like these creatures in distress. The blackbirds and thrushes click like the snail shells they hammer to pieces. The various finches make the noise of cracking seeds, and the woodpecker imitates the tapping on wood which he makes to get the insects that he eats.
But all birds don't give a single note.
No, of course not. The call note arises out of imitation, and then the various bird songs are developed by repeating the call note and descanting upon it.
I see, said Archimedes coldly. And what about me?
Well, you know quite well, said Merlin, that the shrew mouse you pounce upon squeals out, Queek! That is why the young of your species call Kiwik.
And the old?
Inquired Archimedes sarcastically.
"Hooroo! Hooroo!" cried Merlin, refusing to be damped. "It is obvious, my dear fellow. After their first winter, that is the wind in the hollow trees where they prefer to sleep."
"I see," said Archimedes more coolly than ever. "This time, we note, it is not a question of prey at all."
"Oh, come along," replied Merlin. "There are other things besides the things you eat. Even a bird drinks sometimes, for instance, or bathes itself in water. It is the liquid notes of a river that we hear in a robin's song."
"It seems now," said Archimedes, "that it is no longer a question of what we eat, but also what we drink or hear."
"And why not?" the owl said resignedly.
"Oh, well."
"I think it is an interesting idea," said the wart, to encourage his tutor. "But how does a language come out of these imitations?"
"They repeat them at first," said Merlin, "and then they vary them. You don't seem to realize what a lot of meaning there resides in the tone and the speed of voice. Suppose I were to say, 'What a nice day,' just like that. You would answer, 'Yes, so it is.' But if I were to say, 'What a nice day,' in caressing tones, you might think I was a nice person. But then again, if I were to say, 'What a nice day,' quite breathless, you might look about you to see what had put me in a fright. It is like this that the birds have developed their language."
"Would you mind telling us," said Archimedes, "since you know so much about it, how many various things we birds are able to express by altering the tempo and emphasis of the elaborations of our call notes?"
"But a large number of things. You can cry, 'Kee-wick,' in tender accents if you're in love, or 'Kee-wick,' angrily in challenge or in hate. You can cry it on a rising scale as a call note, if you do not know where your partner is, or to attract their attention away if strangers are straying near your nest. If you go near the old nest in the winter time, you may cry, 'Kee-wick,' lovingly, a conditioned reflex from the pleasures which you once enjoyed within it. And if I come near to you in a startling way, you may cry out, 'Kee-wick, kee-wick, kee-wick,' in loud alarm."
"When we come to conditioned reflexes," remarked Archimedes sourly, "I prefer to look for a mouse."
"So you may. And when you find it, I dare say you will make another sound characteristic of owls, though not often mentioned in books of ornithology. I refer to the sound tock, or tsk, which human beings call a smacking of the lips."
"And what sound is that supposed to imitate?"
"Obviously, the breaking of mousy bones."
"You are a cunning master," said Archimedes, "and as far as a poor owl is concerned, you will just have to get away with it. All I can tell you from my personal experience is that it is not like that at all. A tit can tell you not only that it is in danger, but what kind of danger it is in. It can say, 'Look out for the cat,' or 'Look out for the hawk,' or 'Look out for the tawny owl,' as plainly as ABC.
"I don't deny it," said Merlin. "I am only telling you the beginnings of the language. Suppose you try to tell me the song of any single bird which I can't attribute originally to imitation."
"The nightjar," said the wart.
"The buzzing of the wings of beetles," replied his tutor at once.
"The nightingale,"
cried Archimedes desperately.
"Ah," said Merlin, leaning back in his comfortable chair, "now we are to imitate the soul song of our beloved Proserpine, as she stirs to wake in all her liquid self."
"Teroo," said the wart softly.
"Pew,"
added the owl quietly.
"Music,"
concluded the necromancer in ecstasy, unable to make the smallest beginnings of an imitation. "Hello," said Kay, opening the door of the afternoon schoolroom. "I'm sorry I'm late for the geography lesson. I was trying to get a few small birds with my crossbow. Look, I've killed a thrush."
Chapter 18. The wart lay awake as he had been told to do. He was to wait until Kay was asleep, and then Archimedes would come for him with Merlin's magic. He lay under the great bearskin and stared out of the window at the stars of spring, no longer frosty and metallic, but as if they'd been new washed and had swollen with the moisture. It was a lovely evening, without rain or cloud. The sky between the stars was of the deepest and fullest velvet. Framed in the thick western window, Aldebaran and Betelgeuse were racing Sirius over the horizon, the hunting dog star looking back to his master Orion, who had not yet heaved himself above the rim. In at the window came also the unfolding scent of benighted flowers, for the currants, the wild cherries, the plums and the hawthorn were already in bloom, and no less than 5 nightingales within earshot were holding a contest of beauty among the bowery, the looming trees. Wart lay on his back with his bearskin half off him, and his hands clasped behind his head. It was too beautiful to sleep, too temperate for the rug. He watched out at the stars in a kind of trance. Soon it would be the summer again, when he could sleep on the battlements and watch these stars hovering as close as moths above his face, and in the Milky Way at least, with something of the mothy pollen. They would be at the same time so distant that unutterable thoughts of space and eternity would baffle themselves in his sighing breast, and he would imagine to himself how he was falling upward, higher and higher among them, never reaching, never ending, leaving and losing everything in the tranquil speed of space. He was fast asleep when Archimedes came for him.
"Eat this," said the owl, and handed him a dead mouse.
The wart felt so strange that he took the furry atom without protest and popped it into his mouth without any feelings that it was going to be nasty. So he was not surprised when it turned out to be excellent, with a fruity taste, like eating a peach with the skin on, though naturally the skin was not so nice as the mouse.
"Now we had better fly," said the owl. "Just flip to the window-sill here to get accustomed to yourself before we take off."
Wart jumped for the sill and automatically gave himself an extra kick with his wings, just as a high jumper swings his arms. He landed on the sill with a thump, as owls are apt to do, did not stop himself in time, and toppled straight out of the window.
"This," he thought to himself cheerfully, "is where I break my neck." It was curious, but he was not taking life seriously. He felt the castle walls streaking past him and the ground and the moat swimming up. He kicked with his wings, and the ground sank again, like water in a leaking well. In a second, that kick of his wings had lost its effect, and the ground was welling up. He kicked again. It was strange, going forward with the earth ebbing and flowing beneath him, in the utter silence of his down-fringed feathers.
"For heaven's sake,"
panted Archimedes, bobbing in the dark air beside him,
"stop flying like a woodpecker. Anybody would take you for a little owl if the creatures had been imported. What you're doing is to give yourself flying speed with one flick of your wings. You then rise on that flick until you have lost flying speed and begin to stall. Then you give another just as you're beginning to drop out of the air and do a switchback. It is confusing to keep up with you."
"Well," said the wart recklessly, "if I stop doing this, I shall go bump altogether."
"Idiot," said the owl. "Waver your wings all the time like me, instead of doing these jumps with them."
The wart did what he was told, and was surprised to find that the earth became stable and moved underneath him without tilting in a regular pour. He did not feel himself to be moving at all.
"That's better."
"How curious everything looks," observed the boy with some wonder, now that he had time to look about him. And indeed, the world did look curious. In some ways, the best description of it would be to say that it looked like a photographer's negative, for he was seeing one ray beyond the spectrum which is visible to human beings. An infrared camera will take photographs in the dark, when we cannot see, and it will also take photographs in daylight. The owls are the same, for it is untrue that they can only see at night. They see in the day just as well, only they happen to possess the advantage of seeing pretty well at night also. So naturally they prefer to do their hunting then, when other creatures are more at their mercy. To the wart, the green trees would have looked whitish in the daytime, as if they were covered with apple blossom, and now, at night, everything had the same kind of different look. It was like flying in a twilight which had reduced everything to shades of the same colour, and, as in the twilight, there was a considerable amount of gloom.
"Do you like it?"
asked the owl. "I like it very much. Do you know, when I was a fish, there were parts of the water which were colder or warmer than the other parts, and now it is the same in the air."
"The temperature," said Archimedes, "depends on the vegetation of the bottom. Woods or weeds, they make it warm above them."
"Well," said the wart, "I can see why the reptiles, who had given up being fishes, decided to become birds. It certainly is fun."
"You are beginning to fit things together," remarked Archimedes. "Do you mind if we sit down?"
"How does one?"
"You must stall. That means you must drive yourself up until you lose flying speed, and then, just as you feel yourself beginning to tumble, you sit down. Have you never noticed how birds fly upward to perch? They don't come straight down on the branch, but dive below it and then rise. At the top of their rise, they stall and sit down."
"But birds land on the ground, too. And what about mallards on the water? They can't rise to sit on that."
"Well, it is perfectly possible to land on flat things, but more difficult. You have to glide in at stalling speed all the way, and then increase your wind resistance by cupping your wings, dropping your feet, tail, etc. You may have noticed that few birds do it gracefully. Look how a crow thumps down, and how the mallard splashes. The spoon-winged birds, like heron and plover, seem to do it best. As a matter of fact, we owls are not so bad at it ourselves."
"And the long-winged birds, like swifts, I suppose they're the worst, for they can't rise from a flat surface at all."
"The reasons are different," said Archimedes, "yet the fact is true. But need we talk on the wing? I am getting tired."
"So am I."
"Owls usually prefer to sit down every 100 yards.
The wart copied Archimedes in zooming up toward the branch which they had chosen. He began to fall just as they were above it, clutched it with his furry feet at the last moment, swayed backward and forward twice, and found that he had landed successfully. He folded up his wings. While the wart sat still and admired the view, his friend proceeded to give him a lecture about flight in birds. He told how, although the swift was so fine a flyer that he could sleep on the wing all night, and although the wart himself had claimed to admire the way in which rooks enjoyed their flights, the real aeronaut of the lower strata, which cut out the swift, was the plover. He explained how plovers indulged in aerobatics and would actually do such stunts as spins, stall turns, and even rolls for the mere grace of the thing. They were the only birds which made a practice of slipping off height to land, except occasionally the oldest, gayest, and most beautiful of all the conscious aeronauts, the raven. Wart paid little or no attention to the lecture, but got his eyes accustomed to the strange tones of light instead, and watched Archimedes from the corner of one of them. For Archimedes, while he was talking, was absent-mindedly spying for his dinner. This spying was an odd performance. A spinning top which is beginning to lose its spin, slowly describes circles with its highest point before falling down. The leg of the top remains in the same place, but the apex makes circles which get bigger and bigger toward the end. This is what Archimedes was absent-mindedly doing. His feet remained stationary, but he moved the upper part of his body round and round, like somebody trying to see from behind a fat lady at a cinema, and uncertain which side of her gave the best view. As he could also turn his head almost completely round on his shoulders, you may imagine that his antics were worth watching. "What are you doing?" asked the wart. Even as he asked, Archimedes was gone. First there had been an owl talking about plover, and then there was no owl. Only, far below the wart, there was a thump and a rattle of leaves as the aerial torpedo went smack into the middle of a bush, regardless of obstructions. In a minute, the owl was sitting beside him again on the branch, thoughtfully breaking up a dead sparrow. "May I do that?" asked the wart, inclined to be bloodthirsty.
"As a matter of fact," said Archimedes, after waiting to crop his mouthful, "you may not. The magic mouse, which turned you into an owl, will be enough for you. After all, you have been eating as a human all day, and no owl kills for pleasure. Besides, I am supposed to be taking you for education, and as soon as I have finished my snack here, that is what we shall have to do."
"Where are you going to take me?" Archimedes finished his sparrow, wiped his beak politely on the bough, and turned his tender eyes full upon the wart. These great round eyes had, as a famous writer has expressed it, a bloom of light upon them like the purple bloom of powder on a grape.
"I am going to take you," said he slowly, "where no human being has ever been, to see my dear mother Athene, the goddess of wisdom."
It was a long and terrible journey, passing beyond the midnight country of sorrow and the sun-drained wastes of solitude into the undiscovered country of Kennaquare, whose latitude is 91 degrees north and longitude 181 degrees west. Here, in the luminous hollow of a tree stump that had been blasted by lightning and whittled clean by the winds of knowledge, they alighted on the outstretched hands of the goddess. Athene was invisible, or at least the wart never remembered having seen her afterwards. At the time, he did not notice that she was invisible. It only struck him when he woke up next morning, because he was aware of her without seeing her. He was aware that her unthinkable beauty was neither that of age nor of youth, that her eyes were the only things you thought of looking at, and that to be her was terrible, whereas to be with her was the only joy. If you can understand this, she was in herself so unhappy that words only melt in such temperatures, but towards other people she was the spirit of invincible mercy and protection. She lived, of course, beyond sorrow and solitude, and if you follow me, the suffering which had brought her there had left her with a kind of supernatural good manners. She was the conqueror. Archimedes kissed her tenderly. He was not overawed by her, but saluted her, almost with pity, as if he were a man of the world visiting his sister, a nun, who did not understand how to get on in his world, or perhaps a prosperous banker who had always tried to be reasonably decent, meeting the man whose destiny it was to be nailed up and left to die of sunstroke, agony and exhaustion, in order to save the prosperous bankers. Even Archimedes did not understand her. She knew this.
"Hail, mother," said Archimedes. "I have brought you a young human who is to learn things by decree."
When the wart came to think about it afterwards, he realized that he had not only never seen the goddess, but that he had also never heard her speak. The owl spoke, and he spoke, but the words of Athene did not come out of a mouth.
"This part," said Archimedes with a sort of purr, "is at the rate of 30 years in a minute. It is one of our owl's dreams, you know, such as we gain our wisdom from in the sighing of the night."
Athene did not speak, but she held the wart in the hollow of her kind hand, and he knew that he was to look in front of him. He saw the world with his own eyes now, no longer using the strange spectrum which he had experienced since he came out with Archimedes, and no doubt this was done in order to make things easier for him. They needed to be made easier, for it was now his business to watch a world in which a year passed in 2 seconds. It was a world of trees.
"We dream of this," explained Archimedes, "when we perch on a tree in the winds of winter, or sleep in its hollow in the rains of spring."
Sometimes nowadays you can see a cinema film of a flower, for instance, in which one exposure has been taken every hour. In it you see the petals expand and throb open or shut for a day or night until the whole story is over and the seeds have been thrown out upon the wind. There was a woodland now in front of the wart, and in it an oak sapling which grew, flourished, and shed its leaves into nakedness, all in the time during which you could slowly count 3. A whole year had passed in that time, with all its human joys and sorrows.
"This," said Athene, or at any rate it is what she seemed to be saying, in the most glorious of voices, "is called the dream of the tree."
People don't think of trees as alive. We never see them moving unless the wind disturbs them, and then it is not their movement but the wind's. The wart saw now that trees are living and do move. He saw all the forest like seaweed on the ocean's floor, how the branches rose and groped about and waved, how they panted forth their leaves like breathing, and indeed they were breathing, and what is still more extraordinary, how they talked. If you should be at a cinema when the talking apparatus breaks down, you may have the experience of hearing it start again too slowly. Then you will hear the words which would be real words at a proper speed, now droning out unintelligibly in long roars and sighs, which give no meaning to the human brain. The same thing happens with a gramophone whose disc is not revolving fast. So it is with humans. We cannot hear the trees talking, except as a vague noise of roaring and hushing which we attribute to the wind in the leaves, because they talk too slowly for us. These noises are really the syllables and vowels of the trees.
"You may speak for yourselves," said Athene.
Oak spoke first, as became the noblest of all. He stood throbbing his leaves in the twilight, to which time had mixed down day and night, stretching out his great muscular branches, yawning, as if it were, like a noble giant of the earth who cracks his limbs in the morning when he wakes. "Ah," said the oak, "it's good to be alive. Look at my biceps, will you? Do you see how the other trees are afraid of gravity, afraid that he will break their branches off? They point them up in the air or down at the ground, so as to give the old earth giant his least purchase upon them. Now I am ready to challenge gravity, and I can stretch my branches straight out in a line parallel to the earth. He may swing on them for all I care, but bless you, they won't break. Do you know how long I live? 1,000 years is my expectation. 300 years to grow, 300 years to live, and 300 years to die. And when I am dead, what of that?
They make me into timber, into ships and house beams that will be good for another thousand. My leaves come the last and go the last. I am a conservative, I am. And out of my apples they make ink, whose words may live as long as me, even as me, the oak.
Ash said softly, I am the Venus of the forest. I am pliable.
My dear madam, said a rather society box, in smirking, urban, scholastic 18th century accents, a decoction of boxwood promotes the growth of hair, while an oil distilled from its shavings is a cure for hemorrhoids, toothache, epilepsy, and stomach worms. So, at least, we are told.
If it comes to being sarcastic, replied a homely Hazel, who was a good fellow at heart, although he was inclined to snap. May I mention that hazel chips will clear turbid wine in 24 hours, and twigs of hazel twisted together will serve for yeast in brewing? You may be a sort of Lord Chesterfield, but at least you will have to yield to me in the matter of genteel tipsification practised by the elegant gentlemen of your century.
As far as drink goes, said an impossibly female Ivy, who was always clinging to her husband, putting her oar in, and making his life a misery. Ground Ivy is used for clarifying beer.
She simpered when she said the word beer in the most unpleasant way. She was a sour creature in any light.
I don't know why we are talking about drink, said a dignified Beech. But if we are talking about it, I may as well mention that Virgil's drinking bowl, Divini Opus Alcimedontis, was turned out of my wood.
Great men, remarked a close-grained svelte lime, are always going back to the trees. Grinling Gibbons would never carve his nets and baskets out of anything but me. And Salvatore Rosa, said a chestnut, was always painting me.
Coro, said a willow, sighing, was fond of me.
How your humans do spin about, remarked a crafty elm coldly. What a speed they live at! It is rather good sport trying to spot them, and then to drop an old bough on their heads, if you get them directly underneath. But, of course, you have to stand very still and give no signs of dropping it till the actual moment. The cream of the joke is that they make the coffins out of me afterwards.
You always were a treacherous fellow, replied an old ewe. What's the point of it? Surely it's better to help than to hinder. Now, Oak here and a few others of us, we take pride in keeping faith. We like to be steadfast. Everybody prizes me because, like Alder, I scorn to rot in water. My gateposts are more durable than iron, for they do not even rust.
Yes, chimed in some cypresses, sycamores, and others. Live and let live. That's the best motto. We and our sisters are always pleased to see the grass growing under our shade.
On the contrary, said a fir, who always killed the grass beneath him, and a nervous aspen joined in.
Kill or be killed, that's the way to get on.
But please don't talk of killing, added the aspen. The cross was made out of me, and I have trembled ever since. I only kill, you know, because I am frightened. It is a terrible thing, always to be afraid.
A cedar decided to cheer her up. Oh, come, he remarked, twinkling his dusky spines. What's the point of all this argument and boasting about your powers? It seems to me that you all take life too seriously. Look at my old friend Sequoia here, who has had the humorous idea of constructing himself a very hard-looking bark out of soft blotting paper, so that you can punch him without hurting yourself. If it comes to that, look at me. What is my mission in life?
You may think it a humble one, considering my size, but I find it amusing. I am antipathetic to fleas."
All the trees laughed at this. It resulted in a splendid summer that year, and decided to go on with their dance. It was a sort of Indian dance, in which they moved their bodies but not their feet, and a very graceful one it was. The wart watched while the whole troop of them rippled their twigs like serpents, or made slow ritual gestures about their heads and bodies with the larger boughs. He saw how they grew big and lusty in their dancing, how they threw their arms out towards heaven in an ecstasy of being alive. The younger trees tired first. The little fruit trees stopped waving, hung their weary heads for a moment, then fell down on the ground. The big ones moved more slowly, faltered, and fell one by one, till only Oak was left. He stood with his chin sunk upon his chest, kept upright by his mighty will, thinking of the lovely dance which now was over. He sighed and looked upwards to Athene, stretched out his bare arms sorrowfully to her, to ask her why, and then he also fell on sleep.
"The next dream," said Athene, "is called the Dream of the Stones."
"It is the last dream she will give you," added Archimedes, "and this one goes at 2 million years a second. You will have to keep your eyes skinned."
Wart saw a darkness in front of him, with lights in it. The dark was so dark that it was like lamp black, and the light so light that the coldest blue fire of diamonds could not touch them. The harsh contrast between them made his eyes ache. He was looking at Sirius, actually, just as he had been looking at him a few hours before, but it took him quite a time before he realized that he was looking at a star at all. There was none of the mellow velvet which he had been accustomed to see through the Earth's atmosphere, but only this fierce emptiness of black and white. And beside this fact, the constellations were in different positions. It was a few thousand million years ago, and all the shapes of the evening have altered since then. The nearest star, which looked the biggest for that reason, burnt with a roar of terrible gases, and another star was coming towards it. You could see them surging on their endless paths into eternity, marking their aimed but aimless courses across the universe with straight lines of remembered fire, like the meteors with which the Creator sometimes stitched together the weak seams of our dome, the bright darning needles suddenly darted in and out of the velvet by a finger on the other side. As the two stars came closer together, a huge mountain of flame was dragged out by attraction from each. When they were at their closest point, the top of this mountain broke off from the smaller star and streamed through the emptiness towards the bigger. Some of it reached its destination, but the bigger star was proceeding quickly on its way, and some of it was left behind. This part hung in space, lost to both its parents and its seducer, a whirling cigar of fire. Its mists of flame began to crystallize as they cooled, to turn into drops, as water does when it is cooled from steam. The drops took up a circular path of their own, spinning round the star from which they had been dragged. The wart found himself closer to the third drop. Its haze of incandescent worms crawled in and out of it, formed into funnels and whirlpools, crept over its round surface, sometimes leapt out into space, curled over and rained back. They were flames. The light died down from far beyond white to blue to red to a dim brown. It became a ball of steam. Out of this steam, a smaller ball shot out. The first ball shrank and was a globe of boiling water. The water began to cool, but the fires still burnt inside it. They convulsed the surface of the water, threw up great continents and islands of the interior rock. The centuries were passing so quickly that even these continents seemed to bubble like porridge as the volcanoes and mountains and earthquakes came and went. The unbridled furnace within was still unstable, and till quite late in the dream, the globe did not always spin on the same axis, but lurched over sideways as some stress gave way inside. The lurches destroyed continents and made more. The wart found himself closer still. He was actually on the globe and facing an enormous cliff. At 2 million years a second, the cliff's mountain moved. It was alive, as the trees had been, and roared most dreadfully. It fell, it folded on itself, it shoved itself along the surface of the globe, pushing a bow wave of its own folds for miles. Its great rocks split and powdered, pouring stone torrents into the heaving sea. The sea itself grew tired of the mountain, made it to sink down and to be covered. Another convulsion threw up the remains again, streaming. Round the foot of the chastened mountain there lay its powder and its pebbles, great rocks worn smooth by the sea. The rocks themselves broke and were scattered. The sea always rolling and rolling them together between its hands until the tiny fragments were often as round as their mother had been, the globe. A green scum formed over the sinking mountain, a haze of colour which was still sometimes dipped under the water or lifted high above it as the earth undulated. The trees came, but their voices were quite drowned by the slower howling of the mineral world, which twitched through millennia like a dog's skin in sleep. "Hold fast," was what the rocks thundered. "Hold, cohere." But all the time they were broken apart, thrown down, and their hold broken. There was nothing to be seen of the mountain except a flat green plain which had some pebbles on it. They were bits of the cliff which he had first watched. The dream, like the one before it, lasted about half an hour. In the last 3 minutes of the dream, some fishes, dragons, and such like ran hurriedly about. A dragon swallowed one of the pebbles, but spat it out. In the ultimate twinkling of an eye, far tinier in time than the last millimetre on a 6-foot rule, there came a man. He split up the one pebble which remained of all that mountain with blows, then made an arrowhead of it, and slew his brother.
"Well, Wart," said Kay in an exasperated voice, "do you want all the rug? And why do you heave and mutter so? You were snoring, too."
"I don't snore," replied the wart indignantly.
"You do."
"I don't."
"You do. You snore like a volcano."
"I don't."
"You do."
"I don't, and you snore worse."
"No, I don't."
"Yes, you do."
"How can I snore worse if you don't snore at all?"
By the time they'd thrashed this out, they were nearly late for breakfast. They dressed hurriedly and ran out into the spring. Chapter 19. In the evenings, except in the very height of summer, they used to meet in the solar after the last meal of the day. There the parson, Reverend Sidebottom, or if he were busy over his sermon, then Merlin himself, would read to them out of some learned book of tales to calm their spirits. It was glorious in the winter while the big logs roared in the fire, the beech blue flamy and relentless, the elms showy and soon gone, the holly bright or the pine with his smoking scents, while the dogs dreamed of conquest or the boys imagined those sweet maidens letting down their golden hair so that their rescuers might save them out of towers. But almost at any time of the year it was as good. The book they usually used was Gesta Romanorum, whose fascinating tales began with such provoking sentences as, "There was a certain king who had a singular partiality for little dogs that barked loudly," or, "A certain nobleman had a white cow to which he was extremely partial. He assigned 2 reasons for this, first because she was spotlessly white, and next because..." The boys, and for that matter the men, would sit as quiet as church mice while the marvels of the story were unfolded. And when the unpredictable narrative had come to an end, they would look towards Reverend Sidebottom, or Merlin, who was not so good at it, to have the story explained. Reverend Sidebottom would draw a deep breath and plunge into his task, explaining how the certain king was really Christ, and the barking dogs zealous preachers, or how the white cow was the soul, and her milk represented prayer and supplication. Sometimes, indeed generally, the unfortunate vicar was hard put to it to find a moral, but nobody ever doubted that his explanations were the right ones, and anyway, most of his listeners were soon asleep. It was a fine summer night, the last night which would give any excuse for fires, and Reverend Sidebottom was reading out his tale. Wart lay snoozing among the lean ribs of the gaze hounds. Sir Ector sipped his wine with his eyes brooding on the logs which lit the evening. Kay played chess with himself rather badly, and Merlin, with his long beard saffron in the firelight, sat cross-legged knitting beside the wart.
"There was once discovered at Rome," read Reverend Sidebottom through his nose, "an uncorrupted body, taller than the wall of the city, on which the following words were inscribed: Pallas, the son of Evander, whom the lance of a crooked soldier slew, is interred here. A candle burnt at his head, which neither water nor wind could extinguish, until air was admitted through a hole made with a point of a needle beneath the flame. The wound of which this giant had died was 4.5 feet long. Having been killed after the overthrow of Troy, he remained in his tomb 2,240 years.
"Have you ever seen a giant?" asked Merlin softly, so as not to interrupt the reading. "No, I remember you haven't. Just catch hold of my hand a moment and shut your eyes." The vicar was droning on about the gigantic son of Evander. Sir Ector was staring into the fire, and Kay was making a slight click as he moved one of the chessmen. But the wart and Merlin were immediately standing hand in hand in an unknown forest.
"This is the forest of the Burbly Water," said Merlin, "and we are going to visit the giant Galapas. Now listen, you are invisible at the moment because you are holding my hand. I am able to keep myself invisible by an exercise of willpower, an exceedingly exhausting job it is, and I can keep you invisible so long as you hold on to me. It takes twice as much willpower, but there. If, however, you let go of me even for a moment, during that moment you will become visible, and if you do it in the presence of Galapas, he will munch you up in 2 bites. So hold on."
"Very well," said the wart.
"Don't say very well. It isn't very well at all. On the contrary, it is very ill indeed. And another thing, the whole of this beastly wood is dotted with pitfalls, and I shall be grateful if you will look where you are going."
"What sort of pitfalls?"
"He digs a lot of pits, about 10 feet deep, with smooth clay walls, and covers them over with dead branches, pine needles, and such like. Then, if people walk about, they tumble into them, and he goes round with his bow every morning to finish them off. When he has shot them dead, he climbs in and collects them for dinner. He can hoist himself out of a 10-foot pit quite easily."
"Very well," said the wart again, and corrected himself to, "I will be careful." Being invisible is not so pleasant as it sounds. After a few minutes of it, you forget where you last left your hands and legs, or at least you can only guess to within 3 or 4 inches, and the result is that it is by no means easy to make your way through a brambly wood. You can see the brambles all right, but where exactly you are in relation to them becomes more confusing. The only guide to your legs, for the feeling in them soon becomes complicated, is by looking for your footprints. These you can see in the neatly flattened grass below you. And as for your arms and hands, it becomes hopeless unless you concentrate your mind to remember where you put them last. You can generally tell where your body is, either by the unnatural bend of a thorn branch, or by the pain of one of its thorns, or by the strange feeling of centralness which all human beings have, because we keep our souls in the region of our liver.
"Hold on," said Merlin, "and for glory's sake don't trip up."
They proceeded to tread their tipsy way through the forest, staring carefully at the earth in front of them in case it should give way, and stopping very often when an extra-large bramble fastened itself in their flesh. When Merlin was stuck with a bramble, he swore, and when he swore, he lost some of his concentration, and they both became dimly visible like autumn mist. The rabbits upwind of them stood on their hind legs at this and exclaimed, "Good gracious!"
"What are we going to do?" asked the wart. "Well," said Merlin, "here we are at the Burbly Water. You can see the giant's castle on the opposite bank, and we shall have to swim across. It may be difficult to walk when you're invisible, but to swim is perfectly impossible, even with years of practice. You're always getting your nose under water. So I shall have to let go of you until we have swum across in our own time. Don't forget to meet me quickly on the other side."
The wart went down into the warm starlit water, which ran musically like a real salmon stream, and struck out for the other side. He swam fast across and down river with a kind of natural dog stroke, and he had to go about a quarter of a mile below his landing place along the bank before Merlin also came out to meet him, dripping. Merlin swam the breaststroke very slowly and with great precision, watching ahead of him over the bow wave of his beard with that faintly anxious expression of a faithful retriever.
"Now," said Merlin, "catch hold again, and we will see what Galapash is about."
They walked invisible across the sward, where many unhappy-looking gardeners with iron collars round their necks were mowing, weeding, and sweeping by torchlight, although it was so late in what had begun to be a garden. They were slaves.
"Talk in whispers," said Merlin, "if you have to talk."
There was a brick wall in front of them, with fruit trees nailed along it, and this they were forced to climb. They did so by the usual methods of bending over, climbing on each other's backs, giving a hand up from on top, and so forth. But every time that the wart was compelled to let go of his magician for a moment, he became visible. It was like an early cinematograph, flickering very badly, or one of those magic lanterns where you put in slide after slide. A slave gardener, looking at that part of the wall, sadly tapped himself on the head and went away into a shrubbery to be sick.
"Hush,"
whispered Merlin from the top of the wall, and they looked down upon the giant in person as he took his evening ease by candlelight upon the bowling green.
"But he's not big at all,"
whispered the wart disappointedly.
"He is 10 feet high," hissed Merlin, "and that is extremely big for a giant. I chose the best one I knew. Even Goliath was only 6 cubits and a span, or 9 feet 4 inches. If you don't like him, you can go home."
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be ungrateful, Merlin. Only I thought they were 60 feet long, and that sort of thing."
60 feet, sniffed the necromancer.
The giant had heard something at the top of the wall, and looked up towards them, remarking in a rumbling tone,
"How the bats squeak at night!"
Then he poured himself out another hornful of Madeira and tossed it off in one draught. Merlin lowered his voice and explained,
"People find the teeth and bones of creatures like your friend Atlantosaurus, and then they tell stories about human giants. One of them found a tooth weighing 200 ounces. It's dragons, not giants, that grow really big."
"But can't humans grow big too?"
"I don't understand it myself, but it is something about the composition of their bones. If a human was to grow 60 feet high, he would simply snap his bones with the weight of their own gravity. The biggest real giant was Eleazar, and he was only 10 feet and a half.
"Well," said the wart, "I must say it is rather a disappointment. I don't mean being brought to see him," he added hastily, "but that they don't grow like I thought. Still, I suppose 10 feet is quite big, when you come to think of it."
"It is twice as high as you are," said Merlin. "You would just come up to his navel, and he could pitch you up to a cornrick about as high as you can throw a sheaf."
They had become interested in this discussion, so that they got less and less careful of their voices. And now the giant rose up out of his easy chair. He came towards them with a 3-gallon bottle of wine in his hand and stared earnestly at the wall on which they were sitting. Then he threw the bottle at the wall, rather to their left, said in an angry voice, "Beastly screech owls!" and proceeded to stump off into the castle.
"Follow him!" cried Merlin quickly.
They scrambled down off the wall, joined hands, and hurried after the giant by the garden door. In the beginning, the downstairs parts were reasonably civilized, with green baize doors, behind which butlers and footmen, though with iron collars round their necks, were polishing silver and finishing off the decanters. Later on, there were strong rooms with ancient safes in them that contained the various gold cups, epergnes, and other trophies won at jousts and horse races by the giant. Next, there were dismal cellars with cobwebs over the wine bins and dreary-looking rats peeping thoughtfully at the bodiless footprints in the dust, and several corpses of human beings hanging up in the game cupboards until they should be ready to eat. It was like the place for adults only in the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussaud's. At the very bottom of the castle they came upon the dungeons. Here the chalky walls dripped with greasy moisture, and there were pathetic messages and graffiti scratched upon the stone. "Pray for poor Priscilla," said one, and another said, "Oh, if I had only paid for my dog license honestly, I should never have come to this pass." There was a picture of a man hanging from a gallows, with arms and legs sticking out like those of a Guy Fawkes in all directions, and another of a demon with horns. A fifth carving said, "Midnight sun for the 2:30, while the sixth said, "Oh, yeah," and a seventh exclaimed, "Alas, that I should have forgotten to feed my poor canary. Now I am in the same dread doom." A message which had been scratched out said, "Beastly old Gallipass loves Madam Mim, the dirty hound." And somebody else had written, "Repent and be saved, for the kingdom of hell is at hand." There were kisses, dates, pious ejaculations, mottoes such as "Waste not, want not," and "Good night, ladies." Also, hearts with arrows in them, skulls and crossbones, pictures of pigs drawn with the eyes shut, and pathetic messages such as, "Don't forget to take the potatoes off at 12:30. The key is under the geranium. Revenge me on stinking Gallipass, by whom I am foully slain." Or merely, "Mazawati mead for night starvation." It was a grimly place.
"Ha!" cried Gallipass, stopping outside one of his cells. "Are you going to give me back my patent unbreakable helm, or make me another one?"
"It's not your helm," answered a feeble voice. "I invented it, and I patented it, and you can go sing for another one, you beast."
"No dinner tomorrow," said Gallipass cruelly, and went on to the next cell. "What about that publicity?" asked the giant. "Are you going to say that the Queen of Sheba made an unprovoked attack upon me, and that I took her country in self-defence?"
"No, I'm not,"
said the journalist in the cell.
"Rubber truncheons for you," said Galapas, "in the morning." "Where have you hidden my elastic stays?"
thundered the giant at the third cell.
"I shan't tell you," said the cell.
"If you don't tell me," said Galapas, "I shall have your feet burnt."
"You can do what you like."
"Oh, come on," pleaded the giant. "My tummy hangs down without them. If you will tell me where you put them, I will make you a general, and you shall go hunting in Poland in a fur cap. Or you can have a pet lion or a comic beard, and you can fly to America with an armada. Would you like to marry any of my daughters?"
"I think all your propositions are foul," said the cell. "You'd better have a public trial of me for propaganda."
"You are just a mean, horrible bully," said the giant, and went on to the next cell. "Now then," said Galapas, "what about that ransom, you dirty English pig?"
"I'm not a pig," said the cell, "and I'm not dirty, or I wasn't until I fell into that beastly pit. Now I've got pine needles all down my back. What have you done with my toothbrush, you giant? And where have you put my poor little brachet, what?"
"Never mind your brachet and your toothbrush," shouted Galapas. "What about that ransom, you idiot? Or are you too steeped in British sottishness to understand anything at all?"
"I want to brush my teeth," answered King Pellinore obstinately. "They feel funny, if you understand what I mean, and it makes me feel not very well."
"Uomo bestiale," cried the giant, "have you no finer feelings?"
"No," said King Pellinore, "I don't think I have. I want to brush my teeth, and I'm getting cramped through sitting all the time on this bench, or whatever you call it."
"Unbelievable sort!"
screamed the master of the castle.
"Where is your soul, you shopkeeper? Do you think of nothing but your teeth?"
"I think a lot of things, old boy," said King Pellinore. "I think of how nice it would be to have a poached egg, what?"
"Well, you shan't have a poached egg. You shall just stay there until you pay my ransom. How do you suppose I am to run my business if I don't have my ransoms? What about my concentration camps and my $1,000 wreaths at funerals? Do you suppose that all this is run on nothing? Why, I had to send a wreath for King Cuthno Garanir, which consisted of a Welsh harp, 40 feet long, made entirely out of orchids. It said, 'Melodious angels, sing thee to thy rest.'"
"I think that was a very good wreath," said King Pellinore admiringly. "But couldn't I have my toothbrush, what? Dash it all, really it isn't much compared with a wreath like that, or is it?"
"Imbecile!"
exclaimed the giant, and moved on to the next cell.
"We shall have to rescue him," whispered the wart. "It is poor old King Pellinore, and he must have fallen into one of those traps you were telling me about while he was after the questing beast."
"Let him stay," said Merlin. "The chap who doesn't know enough to keep himself out of the clutches of one of these giants isn't worth troubling about."
"Perhaps he was thinking about something else," whispered the wart.
"Well, he shouldn't have been," hissed the magician. "Giants like this do absolutely no harm in the long run, and you can keep them quite quiet by the smallest considerations, such as giving them back their stays. Anybody knows that. If he has got himself into trouble with Galapas, let him stay in it. Let him pay the ransom."
"I know for a fact," said the wart, "that he hasn't got the money. He can't even afford to buy himself a feather bed."
"Then he should be polite," said Merlin doubtfully.
"He is trying to be," said the wart. He doesn't understand very much. Oh, please, King Pellinore is a friend of mine, and I don't like to see him in these forbidding cells without a single helper.
Whatever can we do? Cried Merlin angrily. These cells are firmly locked.
There was really nothing to do, but the magician's louder cry had altered matters into a crisis. Forgetting to be silent as well as invisible, Merlin had spoken too loudly for the safety of his expedition.
Who's there?
Shrieked Galapas, wheeling round at the fifth cell.
It's nothing, cried Merlin. Only a mouse.
The giant Galapas whipped out his mighty sword and stared backwards down the narrow passage with his torch held high above his head.
Nonsense, he pronounced. Mouses don't talk in human speech.
Eek,
said Merlin, hoping that this would do.
You can't fool me, said Galapas. Now I shall come for you with my shining blade, and I shall see what you are, by yea or by nay.
He came down towards them, holding the blue glittering edge in front of him, and his fat eyes were brutal and piggish in the torchlight. You can imagine that it was not very pleasant having a person who weighed 35 stone looking for you in a narrow passage with a sword as long as yourself in the hopes of sticking it in your liver.
Don't be silly, said Merlin. It is only a mouse or 2 mice. You ought to know better. It is an invisible magician, said Galapas. And as for invisible magicians, I slit them up, see? I shed their bowels upon the earth, see? I rip them and tear them, see? So that their invisible guts fall out upon the earth. Now, where are you, magician, so that I may slice and zip?
We are behind you, said Merlin anxiously. Look in that further corner behind your back.
Yes, said Galapas grimly, except for your voice.
Hold on, cried Merlin, but the wart in the confusion had slipped his hand.
A visible magician, remarked the giant, this time, but only a small one. We shall see whether the sword goes in with a slide.
Catch hold, you idiot, cried Merlin frantically, and with several fumblings they were hand in hand.
Gone again,
said Galapas, and swiped with his sword towards where they had been. It struck blue sparks from the stones. Merlin put his invisible mouth right up to the wart's invisible ear and whispered,
Lie flat in the passage. We will press ourselves one to each side and hope that he will go beyond us.
This worked, but the wart, in wriggling along the floor, lost contact with his protector once again. He groped everywhere but could not find him, and of course he was now visible again like any other person.
Ha!
Cried Galapas.
The same small one, equally visible.
He made a swipe into the darkness, but Merlin had snatched his pupil's hand again and just dragged him out of danger.
Mysterious chaps, said the giant. The best thing would be to go snip-snap along the floor. That's the way they cut up spinach, you know, added the giant, or anything you have to chop small.
Merlin and the wart crouched hand in hand at the furthest corner of the corridor, while the horrible giant Galapas slowly minced his way towards them, laughing from the bottom of his thunderous belly and not sparing a single inch of the ground. Click! Click! Went his razor sword upon the brutal stones, and there seemed to be no hope of rescue. He was behind them now and had cut them off.
Goodbye, whispered the wart. It was worth it.
Goodbye, said Merlin. I don't think it was at all.
You may well say goodbye, sneered the giant, for soon
This choppy blade will rip you!
My dear friends, shouted King Pellinore out of his cell, don't you say goodbye at all. I think I can hear something coming, and while there is life, there is hope.
Yeah,
cried the imprisoned inventor, also coming to their help. He feebly rattled the bars of his cell.
You leave those persons alone, you grincing giant, or I won't make you an unbreakable helmet ever.
What about your stays?
Exclaimed the next cell, fiercely, to distract his attention.
Fatty!
I am not fat!
Shouted Galapas, stopping halfway down the passage.
Yes, you are, replied the cell. Fatty! Fatty!
Shouted all the prisoners together.
Fat old Galapas! Fat old Galapas cried for his mummy. He couldn't find his stays, and down fell his tummy.
All right,
said the giant, looking perfectly blue in the face.
All right, my beauties. I'll just finish these two off, and then it will be truncheons for supper.
Truncheons yourself, they answered. You leave those two alone.
Truncheons, was all the giant said. Truncheons and a few little thumbscrews to finish up with. Now then, where are we?
There was a distant noise, a kind of barking, and King Pellinore, who had been listening at his barred window while this was going on, began to jump and hop.
It's it! He shouted in high delight. It's it!
What's it? They asked him.
It! Explained the king. It itself!
While he was explaining, the noise had come nearer and now was clamouring just outside the dungeon door behind the giant. It was a pack of hounds.
Woof!
Cried the door, while the giant and all his victims stood transfixed.
Woof!
Cried the door again, and the hinges creaked.
Woof!
Cried the door for the third time, and the hinges broke.
Wow!
Cried the giant Galapas, as the door crashed to the stone flags with a tremendous slap, and the beast Glatizant bounded into the corridor.
Let go of me, you awful animal!
Cried the giant, as the questing beast fixed its teeth into the seat of his pants.
Help! Help!
Squealed the giant, as the monster ran him out of the broken door.
Good old beast! Yelled King Pellinore from behind his bars. Look at that, I ask you, good old beast! Lew! Fetch him along, then, old lady! Bring him on, then, bring him on! Good old girl, bring him on, then, bring him on! Dead, dead!
Added King Pellinore rather prematurely.
Bring him on dead, then, bring him on dead! There you are, then, good old girl! High lost! Lew! What do you know about that for a retriever entirely self-trained?
Her off!
Barked the questing beast in the far distance.
Her off! Her off!
And they could just hear the giant Galapas running round and round the circular stairs towards the highest turret in his castle. Merlin and Wart hurriedly opened all the cell doors with the keys which the giant had dropped, though the beast would no doubt have been able to break them down if he had not, and the pathetic prisoners came out blinking in the torchlight. They were thin and bleached like mushrooms, but their spirits were not broken.
Well, they said, isn't this a bit of all right?
No more thumbscrews for supper.
No more dungeons, no more stench, said the inventor. No more sitting on this hard bench. I wonder where he can have put my toothbrush.
That's a splendid animal of yours, Pellinore. We owe her all our lives. Three cheers for Glatizant!
And the Bratchet must be somewhere about.
Oh, come along, my dear fellow. You can clean your teeth some other time with a stick or something when we get out. The thing to do is to set free all the slaves and to run away before the beast lets him out of the tower. As far as that goes, we can pinch the epergnes on the way out. Lordy, I shan't be sorry to see a nice fire again. That place fair gives me the rheumatics.
Let's burn all his truncheons and write what we think of him on the walls. Good old Glatizant! 3 cheers for Pellinore! 3 cheers for everybody else! Huzzah! Huzzah! Huzzah!
Merlin and the wart slipped away invisibly from the rejoicings. They left the slaves thronging out of the castle, while King Pellinore carefully unlocked the iron rings from their necks with a few appropriate words, as if he were distributing the prizes on speech day. Glatizant was still making a noise like 30 couple of hounds questing outside the tower door, and Galapas, with all the furniture piled against the door, was leaning out of the tower window shouting for the fire brigade. The occupant of cell number 3 was busily collecting the Ascot gold cup and other trophies out of the giant's safe, while the publicity man was having a splendid time with a bonfire of truncheons, thumbscrews, and anything else that looked as if it would melt the instruments of torture. Across the corridor of the now abandoned dungeons, the inventor was carving a rude message with hammer and chisel, and this said, "Sucks to Galapas." The firelight and the cheering, and King Pellinore's encouraging remarks such as, "Britons never shall be slaves," or, "I hope you will never forget the lessons you have learnt while you were with us here," or, "I shall always be glad to hear from any old slaves how they get on in life," or, "Try to make it a rule always to clean your teeth 2 times a day, combined to make the leave-taking a festive one, from which the 2 invisible visitors were sorry to depart. But time was precious, as Merlin said, and they hurried off towards the burbly water. Considering the things that had happened, there must have been something queer about time, as well as its preciousness, for when the wart opened his eyes in the solar, Kay was still clicking his chessmen, and Sir Ector still staring into flames.
"Well," said Sir Ector, "what about the giant?"
Merlin looked up from his knitting, and the wart opened a startled mouth to speak, but the question had been addressed to the vicar. Reverend Sidebottom closed his book about Pallas, the son of Evander, rolled his eyeballs wildly, clutched his thin beard, gasped for breath, shut his eyes and exclaimed hurriedly,
"My beloved, the giant is Adam, who was formed free from all corruption. The wound from which he died is transgression of the divine command."
Then he blew out his cheeks, let go of his beard, and glanced triumphantly at Merlin.
"Very good," said Merlin, "especially that bit about remaining uncorrupted. But what about the candle and the needle?"
The vicar closed his eyes again, as if in pain, and all waited in silence for the explanation. After they had waited for several minutes, Wart said,
"If I were a knight in armour and met a giant, I should smite off both his legs by the knees, saying, 'Now art thou better of a size to deal with than thou were.' And after that, I should swish off his head."
"Hush," said Sir Ector, "never mind about that."
"The candle," said the vicar wanly, "is eternal punishment, extinguished by means of a needle, that is, by the passion of Christ."
"Very good indeed,"
said Merlin, patting him on the back. The fire burned merrily, as if it were a bonfire which some slaves were dancing round, and one of the gaze hounds next to the wart now went, "Woof, woof," in its sleep, so that it sounded like a pack of 30 couple of hounds questing in the distance, very far away, beyond the night-lit woods. Chapter 20. It was haymaking again, and Merlin had been with them a year. The wind had visited them, and the snow and the rain, and the sun once more. The boys looked longer in the leg, but otherwise everything was the same. 6 other years passed by. Sometimes Sir Grummore came on a visit. Sometimes King Pellinore could be descried galloping over the purlieus after the beast, or with the beast after him if they happened to have got muddled up. Cully lost the vertical stripes of his first year's plumage and became greyer, grimmer, madder, and distinguished by smart horizontal bars where the long stripes had been. The merlins were released every winter and new ones caught again next year. Hob's hair went white. The sergeant-at-arms developed a pot belly and nearly died of shame, but continued to cry out, "One, two!" in a huskier voice on every possible occasion. Nobody else seemed to change at all, except the boys. These grew longer. They ran like wild colts as before, and went to see Robin when they had a mind to, and had innumerable adventures too lengthy to be recorded. Merlin's extra tuition went on just the same, for in those days even the grown-up people were so childish that they saw nothing uninteresting in being turned into owls. The wart was changed into countless different animals. The only difference was that now in their fencing lessons, Kay and his companion were an easy match for the pot-bellied sergeant, and paid him back accidentally for many of the buffets which he had once given them. They had more and more proper weapons as presents when they reached their teens, until in the end they had full suits of armour and bows nearly 6 feet long, which would shoot the clothyard shaft. You were not supposed to use a bow longer than your own height, for it was considered that by doing so you were expending unnecessary energy, rather like using an elephant gun to shoot an Ovis Ammon with. At any rate, modest men were careful not to overbow themselves. It was a form of boasting. As the years went by, Kay became more difficult. He always used a bow too big for him, and did not shoot very accurately with it either. He lost his temper, and challenged nearly everybody to have a fight, and in those few cases where he did actually have the fight, he was invariably beaten. Also, he became sarcastic. He made the sergeant miserable by nagging about his stomach, and went on at the wart about his father and mother when Sir Ector was not about. He did not seem to want to do this. It was as if he disliked it, but could not help it. The wart continued to be stupid, fond of Kay, and interested in birds. Merlin looked younger every year, which was only natural, because he was. Archimedes was married, and brought up several handsome families of quilly youngsters in the tower room. Sir Ector got sciatica. 3 trees were struck by lightning. Master Twitey came every Christmas without altering a hair. Master Passelieu remembered a new verse about King Cole. The years passed regularly, and the old English snow lay as it was expected to lie, sometimes with a robin redbreast in one corner of the picture, a church bell or lighted window in the other, and in the end it was nearly time for Kay's initiation as a full-blown knight. Proportionately as the day became nearer, the two boys drifted apart, for Kay did not care to associate with the wart any longer on the same terms, because he would need to be more dignified as a knight, and could not afford to have his squire on intimate terms with him. The wart, who would have to be the squire, followed him about disconsolately as long as he was allowed to do so, and then went off full miserably to amuse himself alone as best he might. He went to the kitchen. "Well, I am a Cinderella now," he said to himself. "Even if I have had the best of it for some mysterious reason up to the present time in our education, now I must pay for my pleasures and for seeing all those delightful dragons, witches, fishes, camelopards, pismires, wild geese and such like, by being a second-rate squire and holding Kay's extra spears for him, while he hoves by some well or other and jousts with all comers. Never mind. I've had a good time while it lasted. And it's not such bad fun being a Cinderella, when you can do it in a kitchen which has a fireplace big enough to roast an ox." And the wart looked round the busy kitchen, which was coloured by the flames till it looked like hell, with sorrowful affection. The education of any civilised gentleman in those days used to go through 3 stages, page, squire, knight, and at any rate the wart had been through the first 2 of these. It was rather like being the son of a modern gentleman who has made his money out of trade, for your father started you on the bottom rung even then in your education of manners. As a page, Wart had learned to lay the tables with three cloths and a carpet, and to bring meat from the kitchen, and to serve Sir Ector or his guests on bended knee, with one clean towel over his shoulder, one for each visitor, and one to wipe the basins. He had been taught all the noble arts of servility, and from the earliest time that he could remember, there had lain pleasantly in the end of his nose the various scents of mint, used to freshen the water in the ewers, or of basil, chamomile, fennel, hyssop, and lavender, which he had been taught to strew on the rushy floors, or of the angelica, saffron, aniseed, and tarragon, which were used to spice the savouries which he had to carry. So he was accustomed to the kitchen, quite apart from the fact that everybody who lived in the castle was a friend of his, who might be visited on any occasion. Wart sat in the enormous firelight and looked about him with pleasure. He looked upon the long spits, which he had often turned when he was smaller, sitting behind an old straw target soaked in water so that he would not be roasted himself, and upon the ladles and spoons whose handles could be measured in yards, with which he had been accustomed to baste the meat. He watched with water in his mouth the arrangements for the evening meal. A boar's head with a lemon in its jaws and split almond whiskers, which would be served with a fanfare of trumpets, a kind of pork pie with sour apple juice, peppered custard, and several bird's legs or spiced leaves sticking out of the top to show what was in it, and a most luscious-looking frumenty. He said to himself with a sigh, "It is not so bad being a servant after all."
"Still sighing?" asked Merlin, who had turned up from somewhere. "As you were that day when we went out to watch King Pellinore's joust?"
"Oh, no," said the wart. "Or rather, oh, yes, and for the same reason. But I don't really mind. I'm sure I shall make a better squire than old Kay would. Look at the saffron going into that frumenty. It just matches the firelight on the hams in the chimney."
"It is lovely," said the magician. "Only fools want to be great."
"Kay won't tell me," said the wart, "what happens when you are made a knight. He says it is too sacred. What does happen?"
"Only a lot of fuss. You will have to undress him, and put him into a bath hung with rich hangings, and then two experienced knights will turn up. Probably Sir Ector will get hold of old Grummore and King Pellinore, and they will both sit on the edge of the bath and give him a long lecture about the ideals of chivalry, such as they are. When they have done, they will pour some of the bath water over him and sign him with the cross, and then you will have to conduct him into a clean bed to get dry. Then you dress him up as a hermit and take him off to the chapel, and there he stays awake all night, watching his armour and saying prayers. People say it is lonely and terrible for him in this vigil, but it is not at all lonely, really, because the vicar and the man who sees to the candles, and an armed guard, and probably you as well as his esquire, will have to sit up with him at the same time. In the morning you lead him off to bed to have a good sleep. As soon as he has confessed and heard mass, and offered a candle with a piece of money stuck into it as near the lighted end as possible. And then, when all are rested, you dress him up again in his very best clothes for dinner. Before dinner, you lead him into the hall with his spurs and his sword all ready, and King Pellinore puts on the first spur, and Sir Grummore puts on the second, and then Sir Ector girds on the sword, and kisses him and smacks him on the shoulder and says, 'Be thou a good knight.'"
"Is that all?"
"No. You go to the chapel again, then, and Kay offers his sword to the vicar, and the vicar gives it back to him, and after that our good cook over there meets him at the door and claims his spurs as a reward, and says, 'I shall keep these spurs for you, and if at any time you don't behave as a true knight should do, why, I shall pop them in the soup.'"
"That is the end?"
"Yes, except for the dinner."
"If I were to be made a knight," said the wart, staring dreamily into the fire, "I should insist on doing my vigil by myself, as Hob does with his hawks, and I should pray to God to let me encounter all the evil in the world in my own person, so that if I conquered, there would be none left, and if I were defeated, I would be the one to suffer for it."
"That would be extremely presumptuous of you," said Merlin, "and you would be conquered, and you would suffer for it."
"I shouldn't mind."
"Wouldn't you? Wait till it happens and see."
"Why do people not think when they're grown up as I do when I'm young?"
"Oh, dear," said Merlin, "you are making me feel confused. Suppose you wait till you're grown up and know the reason."
"I don't think that's an answer at all," replied the wart, justly. Merlin wrung his hands.
"Well, anyway," he said, "suppose they did not let you stand against all the evil in the world."
"I could ask," said the wart.
"You could ask," repeated Merlin.
He thrust the end of his beard into his mouth, stared tragically at the fire, and began to munch it fiercely. Chapter 21. The day for the ceremony drew near. The invitations to King Pellinore and Sir Grummore were sent out, and the wart withdrew himself more and more into the kitchen.
"Come along, wart, old boy," said Sir Ector ruefully. "I didn't think you would take it so bad. It doesn't become you to do this sulking."
"I'm not sulking," said the wart. "I don't mind a bit, and I'm very glad that Kay is going to be a knight. Please don't think I'm sulking."
"You are a good boy," said Sir Ector. "I know you're not sulking, really, but do cheer up. Kay isn't such a bad stick, you know, in his way."
"Kay is a splendid chap," said the wart. "Only I was not happy because he did not want to go hawking or anything with me any more."
"It is his youthfulness," said Sir Ector. "It will all clear up."
"I'm sure it will," said the wart. "It's only that he does not want me to go with him just at the moment, and so, of course, I don't go. But I will go," added the wart, "as soon as he commands me. I will do exactly what he says. Honestly, I think Kay is a good person, and I was not sulking a bit."
"You have a glass of this canary," said Sir Ector, "and go and see if old Merlin can't cheer you up."
"Sir Ector has given me a glass of canary," said the wart, "and sent me to see if you can't cheer me up."
"Sir Ector," said Merlin, "is a wise man."
"Well," said the wart, "what about it?"
"The best thing for being sad," replied Merlin, beginning to puff and blow, "is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. You may grow old and trembling in your anatomies. You may lie awake at night listening to the disorder of your veins. You may miss your only love. You may see the world about you devastated by evil lunatics, or know your honour trampled in the sewers of baser minds. There is only one thing for it, then, to learn. Learn why the world wags and what wags it. That is the only thing which the mind can never exhaust, never alienate, never be tortured by, never fear or distrust, and never dream of regretting. Learning is the thing for you. Look at what a lot of things there are to learn. Pure science, the only purity there is. You can learn astronomy in a lifetime, natural history in three, literature in six, and then, after you have exhausted a myriad lifetimes in biology and medicine and theocriticism and geography and history and economics, why, you can start to make a cartwheel out of the appropriate wood, or spend 50 years learning to begin to learn to beat your adversary at fencing. After that, you can start again on mathematics until it is time to learn to plough."
"Apart from all these things," said the wart, "what do you suggest for me just now?"
"Let me see,"
said the magician, considering. "We have had a short 6 years of this, and in that time I think I am right in saying that you have been many kinds of animal, vegetable, mineral, etc., many things in earth, air, fire, and water."
"I don't know much," said the wart, "about the animals and earth."
"Then you had better meet my friend the badger."
"I've never met a badger."
"Good," said Merlin. "Except for Archimedes, he is the most learned creature I know. You will like him. By the way," added the magician, stopping in the middle of his spell, "there is one thing I ought to tell you. This is the last time I shall be able to turn you into anything. All the magic for that sort of thing has been used up, and this will be the end of your education. When Kay has been knighted, my labours will be over. You will have to go away then to be his squire in the wide world, and I shall go elsewhere. Do you think you have learned anything?"
"I have learned, and been happy."
"That's right, then," said Merlin. "Try to remember what you have learned."
He proceeded with the spell, pointed his wand of lignum vitae at the little bear, which had just begun to glow in the dimness as it hung by its tail from the North Star, and called out cheerfully,
"Have a good time for the last visit. Give my love to Badger."
The call sounded from far away, and Wart found himself standing by the side of an ancient tumulus, like an enormous molehill, with a black hole in front of him. "Badger lives in there," he said to himself, "and I'm supposed to go and talk to him. But I won't. It was bad enough never to be a knight, but now my own dear tutor that I found on the only quest I shall ever have is to be taken from me also, and there will be no more natural history. Very well, I will have one more night of joy before I am condemned, and as I am a wild beast now, I will be a wild beast, and there it is." So he trundled off fiercely over the twilight snow, for it was winter. If you are feeling desperate, a badger is a good thing to be. A relation of the bears, otters, and weasels, you are the nearest thing to a bear now left in England, and your skin is so thick that it makes no difference who bites you. So far as your own bite is concerned, there is something about the formation of your jaw which makes it almost impossible to be dislocated, and so, however much the thing you are biting twists about, there is no reason why you should ever let go. Badgers are one of the few creatures which can munch up hedgehogs unconcernedly, just as they can munch up everything else, from wasps' nests and roots to baby rabbits. It so happened that a sleeping hedgehog was the first thing which came in the wart's way.
"Hedge pig," said the wart, peering at his victim with blurred, short-sighted eyes. "I'm going to munch you up."
The hedgehog, which had hidden its bright little eye buttons and long sensitive nose inside its curl, and which had ornamented its spikes with a not very tasteful arrangement of dead leaves before going to bed for the winter in its grassy nest, woke up at this and squealed most lamentably.
"The more you squeal," said the wart, "the more I shall gnash. It makes my blood boil within me."
"Ah, Mr. Brock," cried the hedgehog, holding himself tight shut. "Good Mr. Brock, show mercy to a poor urchin, and don't he be tyrannical. Us bean't no common tiggy, maester, for to be munched and mumbled. Have mercy, sir, on a harmless, flea-bitten crofter, which can't tell his left hand nor his right."
"Hedgehog," said the wart remorselessly, "forbear to whine, neither thrice nor once."
"Alas, me poor wife and childer."
"I bet you have not got any. Come out of that, thou tramp. Prepare to meet thy doom."
"Mr. Brock," implored the unfortunate pig,
"'Come now, don't ye be awkward, sweet Maister Brock, my duck. "'Hearken to an urchin's prayer. "'Grant the dear boon of life to this most uncommon tiggy, lordly Maister, "'and he shall sing to thee in numbers sweet, "'or teach ye how to suck cow's milk in the pearly dew.'
"'Sing?' cried the wart, quite taken aback.
"'Aye, sing!'
cried the hedgehog, and it began hurriedly to sing in a very placating way, but rather muffled, because it dared not uncurl.
"'Oh, Genevieve!'
it sang most mournfully into its stomach.
"'Sweet Genevieve! The days may come, the days may go, but still the light of a memory weaves those gentle dreams of long ago.'
It also sang, without pausing for a moment between the songs, Home Sweet Home and The Old Rustic Bridge by the Mill. Then, because it had finished its repertoire, it drew a hurried but quavering breath and began again on Genevieve. After that, it sang Home Sweet Home and The Old Rustic Bridge by the Mill.
"Come," said the wart, "you can stop that. I won't bite you."
"Clementious Maister," whispered the hedge pig humbly. "O shall bless the saints and board of governors for thee, and for thy most kindly chops, so long as fleas skip nor urchins climb up chimblies."
Then, for fear that its brief relapse into prose might have hardened the tyrant's heart, it launched out breathlessly into Genevieve for the third time.
"Stop singing," said the wart, "for heaven's sake. Uncurl. I won't do you any harm. Come, you silly little urchin, and tell me where you learnt these songs."
"Uncurl is one word,"
answered the porpentine tremblingly. It did not feel in the least fretful at the moment.
"But curling up is still another. If he was to see my little naked nose, Maister, at this dispicious moment, he might feel a twitching in thy white toothsomes, and all's fear in love and war that we do know. Let us sing to thee again, sweet Maister Brock, concerning thick there rustic mill."
"I don't want to hear it any more. You sing it very well, but I don't want it again. Uncurl, you idiot, and tell me where you learnt to sing."
"Us bean't no common urchin,"
quavered the poor creature, staying curled up as tight as ever.
"Us for a took when little by one of them there gentry like, as it might be from the mother's breast. Ah, don't he nip our tender vitals, lovely Maister Brock, for he wore a proper gentleman, he wore, and brought us up full comely on cow's milk, and that supped out from a lordly dish. Ah, there bain't many urchins what a drunken water out of porcelain, that there bain't."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said the wart.
"He wore a gentleman," cried the hedgehog desperately. "Like I tell ye, he took on when us wore little and fed on when us hadn't no more. He wore a proper gentleman what fed us into parlour, like what no urchin hadn't seen afore nor since, fed out from gentleman's porcelain. Aye, and a dreary day at war, whenever us left un for naught but wilfulness, that the mayst be sure."
"What was the name of this gentleman?"
"He wore a gentleman, he wore. He hadn't no proper name, like, not like you may remember, but he wore a gentleman, that he wore, and fed un out of porcelain."
"Was he called Merlin?" asked the wart curiously.
"Ah, that wore his name, a proper fine name it wore, but us never lay tongue to it by nary means. Ah, Mearn, he called to itself, and fed un out of porcelain like a proper fine gentleman."
"Oh, do uncurl," exclaimed the wart. "I know the man who kept you, and I think I saw you yourself when you were a baby in cotton wool at his cottage. Come on, urchin, I'm sorry I frightened you. We're friends here, and I want to see your little grey, wet, twitching nose, just for old time's sake."
"Twitching nose be one name,"
answered the hedgehog obstinately.
and a twitching of that nose be another, maester. Now you move along, kind Maester Brock, and leave a poor crofter to take his winter drowse. Let you think of beetles or honey, sweet baron, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest."
"Nonsense," exclaimed the wart. "I won't do you any harm, because I knew you when you were little."
"Ah, them badgers," said the poor thing to its stomach. "They go a-barrowing about with no harm in their hearts, Lord bless 'em, but don't they fair give you a nip without a noticing of it? And, Lord bless ye, what is a retired mun to do? It's that there skin of theirs, that's what it be. From earliest childer they've been a-nipping of among each other, and also of their mars, without a feeling of anything among themselves. So naturally their nips elsewhere like the same. Now, my poor gentleman, Maester Mearn, they was allus a rushing out of his ankles with their yick, yick, yick when they wanted to be fed like. Those what he kept from littles. And holy church, how he would scream. Aye, 'tis a mollicky thing to deal with they badgers, that us may be sure." "Don't see nothing," added the hedgehog before the wart could protest. "Blunder along like one of their ambling hearthrugs on the outsides of their girt feet. Get in the way for a moment, just out of fortune like, without nary wicked intention, and 'tis snip-snap, just like that, out of self-defence for the hungry blind, and then where are you? Only place us can do for un," continued the urchin, "is to hit unto noos. Achilles' heel, the name un, unto scriptures, hit one of their girt trollers unto nose, bim-bam, like that here, and the sharp life is fair out of him ere he can snuffle. 'Tis a fair knockout, that is. But how can a poor urchin dump un unto nose, when he ain't got nothing to dump with, nor way to hold un? And then they comes about he and asks he for to uncurl."
"You need not uncurl," said the wart resignedly. "I'm sorry I woke you up, chap, and I'm sorry I frightened you. I think you are a charming hedgehog, and meeting you has made me feel more cheerful again. You just go off to sleep, like you were when I met you, and I shall go to look for my friend Badger, as I was told to do. Good night, urchin, and good luck in the snow."
"Good night, it may be,"
muttered the pig grumpily.
"And then again it mayn't. First it's uncurl, and then it's curl. One thing one moment, and another thing to next. Hey-ho, 'tis a turvy world. But good night, ladies, is my motto. Come hail, come snow, and so shall be continued in our next."
With these words, the humble animal curled himself